Blog Talk Radio.
Of Masonic effects. It's always interesting. We find that sometimes Blog Talk is affected in this part of the world by atmospheric conditions, and today is one of them. And there's no way of determining that until just minutes before the program is scheduled, and it is live. So you know we put up with that. Thank you very much for your tolerance. I should have and I need to thank you all. A bit of a shout out. The demographics of the program is changing a little bit. Just to go over this really briefly, we're getting listeners from Brazil, the United States, France, India, and Russia, as well as the United Kingdom. So thank you. I'm pleased that we serve a purpose and meet a need. I like to think, and I appreciate we appreciate the support, and I think it speaks to the relevance. At least I want to believe that. So thank you. We're going to continue on with the discussion and dialogue. How are you all? I hope things are going well in your part of the world. It's interesting. Today's program, Task and Commitment, Masonry Unvarnished, is a backdrop for the galvanizing conversation that needs to emerging gradually within our order. And this order gives us purpose. It gives us a frame of reference that, for example, precipitates a connection that we all have with one another through this program. And the format is one of opinion and discussion. I hope it's a bit stimulating and challenging and sometimes provocative. If it wasn't, then I think I'm failing Masonry. I've mistaken the way I'm in translating and interpreting it. So we bring forward the arts and the music, the poetry, the aspiration of Masonry for many of us. Now, today and in the future programs, we're going to be talking more about stakeholders and shareholders. I began to, you know, came across that concept or reading some work from a European writer, and it occurred to me that it was an interesting way of thinking about our order. Always, there's no roadmap, there's no guidebook for Masonry. So we're continuously, I think, wanting to be good scholars to reference, to verify opinion. And I think we can talk about the marble that was used by Da Vinci, or the lighting in Monet's garden. We can talk about that for a long time, but it doesn't really distract us from the point that we're talking about genius. We're talking about ability. So is masonry the product of genius? Well, cumulatively, I think we've struck that bell. I think we can admit that it's fascinating, and it's worthy of study. It's worthy of concern. Whether you're whether a member is a passerby who feels drawn to the pageantry, to the sense of history. That, I think, is all right. There's room, I think, in the order for that type of fellow. Where you are in the world, there will be certain checkpoints or tests of commitment. That varies from a very strident commitment, years of work, presence. Your commitment in some jurisdictions, in many, is shown by your willingness to participate, to become more engaged, so that you can give everybody a look at you. And that it sets a benchmark. If you are active at the start, the benchmark is that you will be active as you move along. And I think that's a reasonable expectation. And in other areas, it's handled with much more flexibility. I think the way we go about that speaks to not whether one is better than another, but it gives us an opportunity to examine outcomes. And that gives us a pause to consider the ideals, the direction of the order, the purpose of the order, and then within our own minds determine whether which approach seems to have more appeal, which is more effective. You may have great, having an appeal is what, in a loose kind of a way, fueled the junk food industry around the world. It's terrible for the health of our children and for us, but it appeals to us because it appeals to our sense of taste, not nutrition. In this culture, the society that I've been living in, we've been taught a long time ago that the pleasing yourself is the goal, not to consider your overall health, and but to satisfy yourself. You work hard so that you can play hard, and you, as you play, whether you're not taking care of your health is secondary to the fact that there's an excitement, and it's the excitement that's promoted. We have major sporting events that give us a moment to scream to the stars, to get to feel that collective energy. And it's amazing. It's an unusual feeling. It's the same feeling one gets when you're sitting in an opera house and the hair on your arms stands up as the music reaches certain emotional points. You who are fans or have listened will understand more fully than I could explain what that's about. But the same kind of energy happens and for young people in raves, where it's a crescendo after crescendo after crescendo, and of light and sound and motion and energy. So we like to play on energy. And then We have cultures that are the cafe, where your pleasure is ordering a cappuccino or a latte, sitting with your paper, with a good friend, conversation. The weather is almost secondary. Put on a warm coat if it's a bit chilly. Have a cup of mocha. Watch the experience, and experience the people around. It's that kind of a setting is where you're in the natural art gallery, where you're looking at the changes. You're sitting there contemplating what you're reading in your paper or your book. Over a glass of wine, perhaps, and the people come in and out of your frame of vision. And some are in earnest, some are very languid. It's to the discerning mind, it reveals stories about people and stories about us. And whether you can draw satisfaction or joy or pleasure from the spending an hour and seeing the changing shadows, and does that mean anything? Well, there's no profit in that, is there? The culture that I've been in has been experimenting with the promotion of profit at all costs. I would socialize, I would be the particular sports and activities that I chose would allow me to socialize with people that can benefit me in some way, and I them. Everything is there for a purpose. This has permeated our educational system. We would rather have people in engineering than in studying the humanities. Well, a few years ago, 2008, I believe, we saw the effects of some very dodgy decisions being made by investment houses. And it caused a collapse of the world economy. It caused shrinkage. It was a serious impact of the world economies because of speculations. One path that led to was the Occupy movement. When these rebels, these cowboys, I think they were called, were right, they rolled the dice, and when they were right, they accumulated massive amounts of profit, which went into their pocket, or the pocket of the investment house they were working with. If they failed, the payment of that came out of the pockets of investors like you and I. And the Occupy movement began when they were fueled by those observations to realize there was something wrong with this picture. If there is profit, should that not equally be shared as the risk is being shared? So if you can get yourself into that kind of a world where there's no risk, I know there are a lot of people that will be listening in that will say, well, of course, there is major risk, and you get redeemed for assuming that risk and the work behind it. I have no issue with that. It's the impact, the cumulative impact of the downside. The house always wins. Yeah, that's the general thinking. The stock markets will always rebound. So there's been some byproduct, and the byproduct now is this polarization that's going on around the globe. That notion of the global community is achievable. It's there with us, and we're learning about it by sitting and watching these vignettes, these collectives of people walking around and walking on their way, walking in earnest or strolling along with their good friend, their partner, and we're learning more about ourselves. And inside that inside that experience, we are Masonic Effects is unpacking the effect on Masonry, and that's a part of what's fueled the commentary today. So sit back for a second and relax with me. Fill up your favorite beverage, as I have. This is very old, and I believe you'll find that this is the Heinz and Weiss Quintet. This is called Lulu's Swing. It's an original, and I think you'll like it. Not so very long ago, this was the kind of music that was being played, and we would take out go out with our friends and relax and be distracted. It was music from a time when the air still contained the smoke of cannon fire. The sounds of battle, not the movie version, but the reality of it, the ability of men to control their fear and focus on the battle. It was a different time. But it puts a question to us as Masons that I think is, and to the world, that is important. Masonry, I always feel, is a reflection and a window. You step through that, it reflects the world around us if we choose to look in that mirror. If we step through the window, step through that, then we're starting to unpack meaning. Unpack meaning. So we make the observation. What do we see in the mirror? Well, the first thing we see is ourselves. Reflected back. And then if we look over our shoulder, we see a great deal of activity, don't we? So it is there a bearing? The bearing here is like this. Are we capable on an individual basis and a collective basis of learning from our history? Well, history itself seems to tell us that yes. Heinz, that means what we're talking about isn't history descriptive. We're talking about history, the experience, the cognitive experience. It's hindsight. Can we learn from hindsight? Yes. Yes. Quite ready. Now, what we're hearing here today is some of the music from around the world that reveals a moment of pause. We were tired. We had collectively, directly or indirectly, experienced a major struggle, terrorism on a global scale. That being the uncertainty, how will it stop? Will it stop? What will make it stop? What will happen to me in the meantime? Me, the well-being of the people that I care about. On a global scale, can you imagine? It's very hard today if you were born after that period. But if we begin to use a bit of the new science, the newest, newer forms of science, it may reveal answers that are helpful to us all. Here, the question is whether people are motivated by anything else other than being self-serving. Now, that's an interesting question, isn't it? It speaks to us about altruism. Can you truly be motivated by the act of support or empathy for your fellow men? Well, that's in your mind. You may have you will reason that out. The struggle, I think, with it is that it has a great many conclusions. The outcomes, the math of it, doesn't add up necessarily in a uniform kind of a way. Although, you know, if we were obeying all those rules, if all of this was following the rules of mathematics or geometry or physics, it releases a very unusual collective power. And sometimes under certain conditions, threat, the existential threat, our capacity to follow the rules, to find a rule and follow it, obedience, falls into place. And we see that it has happened historically time and time again, and it prevails. it prevails over this sense of right and wrong and power. So we get into living according to certain clear principles, and then it's not that we deny them. The price we pay for those kind of battles is so great. The wounded continues on. The wounded continue to walk, and some of the wounded continue to suffer throughout a lifetime, and others of that wounded group find happiness, find an ability to encapsulate the danger and risk that they experienced, and move on. And in a very contemporary kind of a language, they live in the now. They live in the moment. They live in the here and now. They enjoy the sound of their grandchildren, the feel of the air on their face, the sounds on the shore. They enjoy and appreciate their friends and friendship. And for some, I think the more fortunate, they begin to explore and experience the benefits of a spiritual existence and begin to ask those essential questions. No, we're not here to answer those. We can comment on them, but you have answers for yourself. And if you are beginning to raise those questions, you've reached that point of intellectual maturity, then you will already be on the path of reason. And you will be on the path, you'll find along the path there are barriers and reasons to stumble. But you will find that it is progressive because there's some ultimate truths that we experience, whether we like it or not. The world is changing in some ways, and in other ways, it remains very much the same. Today, I want to share with you the commentary, Task and Commitment, Masonry Unvarnished. We've done a series of these a couple of years ago, Masonry Unvarnished. And I love the concept. Maybe I'm talking about the 16th century painters who put varnish over their works to preserve them, and that varnish has yellowed, and now we find restoration, able to remove the varnish, and we see these startling and dramatic colors. So maybe we're just pulling the varnish off the old works, the work of the masterpiece. Why are we so inspired by the acts of other people? I want to know, what is it that stirs us so deeply? It is us, the corpus of masonry that has changed so greatly, the product of societal change that has made us shy from our spiritual presence, is it? We're shy. We read about this sense of some of the ritual and meetings and many writers have captured the prayerful nature of those experiences. And today, in many ways, we continue with that, but we continue with those practices. But we're shy about the experience, I think. If we consider each of us arrives at this point from a unique path through the past, and if we take into account that masonry cultivates the mind, the counterbalance for the independence of thought is a strong sense of community. It's the counterbalance. We have independent thinking. Oh, is the risk that we're all going to become radicalized by our own thoughts? Well, if that was the only thing, if we could stop time and space and stop all other thoughts, I guess we could consider that every thought of every independent thought could lead to something quite disorienting. Bah, but au contraire, we have this uncommon ability. We have this strong sense of community, the reality, the environment around us, and all the aspects of it. It is also uncommon for a man to have an answer to the larger social problems he experiences. Does he have an obligation to address need? He does if he is a Mason. Why? Because we are all of one nature. Circumstance is unpredictable. Permanence is illusory. This too will pass, as a good friend has taught me over the years. Life would be different if we had a dress rehearsal. Masonry is a tool that improves performance with practice. Thank goodness. The principled life brings value when it is applied with imagination and purpose. If you apply it in a rigid way, it is essentially a tool to a particular ideology. But if you're looking at this, the application with imagination, what I'm saying is here, we're teaching you, we're giving you the tools and mentoring you in the studios of great people with great ability, because we believe that you have that unrestrained, that restrained talent within you. And our purpose collectively is to help you, to benefit all of us, to find your muse, to find your talent, to find what you're good at, to improve yourself. Because when we do that, we find that inspiring. I'm not talking here about hubris. Does this suggest Masonry is an ideology? Is listening to Mozart ideology? Is the study of the arts and sciences an ideology? Is walking with a close friend ideology? No. Masonry is about meaning. What does it all mean? What is my role in the bigger picture? Does my life matter? If you practice Masonry, and you don't have to be a Mason necessarily, the ethics and principles are this great uniformity that's out there. It's part of the universe. But if you're fortunate enough to have it organized in the order, through the order, and be connected with through the history of the order, with the basis of these ideas, you find Masonry is about meaning. If you practice Masonry, you will find your path includes some surprises, and if you are diligent, rewards that feed the soul. Here's part of that ongoing universal music. The music that I think, I'm just sitting back thinking, and you can help me with this, all of the listeners from all over the world. What is the music? Is there a type of music or an art form that appeals to all 6.5-7 billion of us? Maybe it's like this. Thank you. Back and we listen to the music and we can either hear the separation and how it's different and doesn't speak to us, or we can hear the bounce, the enthusiasm, the joy, the joie de vivre. You think about the period of time. The arts and sciences were well developed in that part of the world. And I bring this up because it's kind of a curious phenomena. Something crept up on that group that were enjoying themselves, good food, good drink, sculpture, art, new movements. Listen to this kind of music, this jazz. It was new and people were socializing in new ways, and the role of the women, our great-great-grandmothers, was changing dramatically and progressive. Not everybody, everywhere. Progress is, after all, a sloppy process. It doesn't have that uniform military cleanliness. And if we start to think about the military, we know that they can't continue on with some illusions too. Anyway, the reality is, it was a time where the people were much like us. If you were fortunate and you had a means of employment, you could pay your bills, live comfortably, and take care of your family. But what crept up was this. The disenfranchised wasn't intentional. The disenfranchised, the unemployed, the people that began to feel helpless and hopeless, who began to feel that the social structure as it was didn't include them. And it went on to such an extent that those numbers grew. And maybe it had something to do with a form of depression that's out there. I don't know. But those numbers grew. And while the party was going on, there were a lot of people feeling that they hadn't been invited to the party. Well, one thing that's important is if all of us are motivated by something internal, to take care of ourselves, then we're going to respond to offers. We're going to respond to solutions to our problems. If the problem is we feel isolated and alone and vulnerable, when we're offered an opportunity to belong, to fit, to have clearer, uniform answers, and the cost of that is an ideology that provides more benefits than downside, then we'll feel drawn to it. And that's what happened in this part of the world. Well, okay, so we're not talking about the assassination, the shot that was heard around the world of the First World War. We're talking about a different kind of a process that led to something that the war that broke the contract. It broke the contract of the war to end all wars. It was a couple of years later in the 30s that it began again. I'm not here today to talk about the indignity and the horror. What I'm talking about is our nature. And what history in hindsight tells us about our nature. Our nature is consistent and it's healthy, but it's imperfect. And our nature is collectively a bit sloppy. We aren't totalitarian. And while some thinkers may believe that if we were, it would solve some problems, social problems, there's always a downside. You remember that I was looking at the work of looking at the translations of Utopia, and we find that and I put the question to all of you, the idea of Utopia. Was Thomas More offering us the panacea? Here we could have everybody would have a house and everybody would have a job, but certain things would have to happen when you were 30. There was a downside, and the downside of the utopia that More illustrated for us was what we refer to as an authority, as a totalitarian state. To achieve that utopia required us to suspend control to central authorities, to a mathematics. And so he offers us in a tantalizing way some ideas that are quite dramatic and wonderful. But he also illustrates the price that we would pay in order to achieve them. So is the price of peace, the price that we pay for peace is to annihilate everybody else. You know, is an annihilation. Then that seems to be an incomplete idea. It's a model that is simply incomplete. Our nature is caring and thoughtful, and we have benefited from the genius of people throughout time. All people everywhere in the globe have contributed, if we're good historians. But I'm a product of Dr. Margaret Macmillan's thinking and influence. I'm greatly influenced by her ideas about the potential for the manipulation of history to serve a person's purpose. So she teaches, if we want to learn from history, we need to look at the good, the bad, I'm paraphrasing here, the good, the bad, and the ugly of it. It is what it is. Here's a piece from, before I do that, I'm going to talk about the London Jazz Club back in the early, just at the end of, shortly after the war. I want to talk to you about a French poet, Charles Baudelaire. here's why I bring it up, and I think it's worth listening to. Here's just some ideas that he shared with the world. The unique and supreme voluptuousness of love lies in the certainty of committing evil. Really? Let's order a glass of wine and talk about that, Charles. The men and women know from birth that in evil is found all sensual delight. I didn't learn, and I wasn't paying attention as usual. It goes on to say, modernity is the transitory, the fugitive, the contingent, which make up one half of art, the other being the eternal and the immutable. Isn't that interesting? What's modern and new is transitory. So a new art form is transitory in the moment, but in the future, it becomes immutable. I think about Cubism or the Bauhaus, you know, or the Impressionists. You can imagine when those debates were going on about whether this is a legitimate art form, and they're being criticized, and they're feeling quite vulnerable. And then there is an interest taken in it. Now, is the interest because they're marginal? I don't know who would know. But today, it's certainly intellectually, when you begin to understand, as you know, what the Impressionists were attempting to do, I think, and what the Cubists were doing, going beyond our perception. This is really quite amazing. Thank you, Picasso. He says this transitory fugitive element, which is constantly changing, must not be despised or neglected. Baudelaire gives us sort of both sides, but it's like he wants us to think about things, but he's also saying, you know, there's a downside to it. Listen, nothing can be done except little by little. Nature is nothing but the inner voice of self-interest. That's why I brought it up today. That's why I brought this remarkable poet up today. You know, he's fascinating, a fascinating mind. He was born on the 9th of April, 1821. So he's been an influence in Masonry Masonic thought. He was a French poet, but he was also an essayist and an art critic, and he was one of the first translators of Edgar Allan Poe. And he wrote extensively about the different luminaries of French culture, a lot going on. And his acquaintance with numerous renowned persons, Gustave Courbet, Franz Liszt, Victor Hugo, Gustave Flaubert, and Balzac. You know, you think it's like you keep the company of interesting people because the conversation is lively, because it's mutually rewarding. You thrive, you feed on that. Not a constant banquet, but there's times when you have that taste. Maybe you sit down and you like lobster, but you want to eat it every single day? Probably not, hey? It's remarkable to think that Baudelaire is bringing something important to us. And talking to us about does that take away the fun of it? In our childlike manner wanting to have ideas that are uncomplicated? Everything's wonderful. It's Christmas every day. Why can't I eat ice cream all the time? Well, after a while, we quickly grow up. So. And that experience helps round us. Here's a voice from the. Now remember, this is and think of yourself. It brings to mind a time when I was on an Air Force base here in Canada. Summer camp. Many of you have done that as boys. And we had a night, thousands of us, we had a night of entertainment. So anybody that had something that they could do, a song or some funny story or jokes, would take the stage, and we were the audience. And one fellow I remember, and they were boxing, you know, the two tough guys that wanted to get all hormonal and pushy. Well, you know, quickly what the sergeant did, he organized a boxing match and put gloves on the skinny little pundits and have at it with an audience if you think you're so tough. It was great entertainment. Well, this one fellow played the piano, and he was pretty, I remember at the time thinking he was pretty good, but he only knew one song like that. He knew little passages, and he played the piano, and the place erupted. It was great. It was good entertainment. And when the noise subsided a bit, there was like the audience wanted more and more, and he said, "That's the only song I know." So the audience demanded, in a way, that he play encores, and he played the same song over two or three times. And it was great. It was just this rapturous moment. And then we had to get up early in the morning and go about our drills and our work. But memories. Here's a memory that I hope is strong with many of you around the world. Draw on, let this be a reminder of an earlier time for you. And the joy of being able to sit down and just connect. This is Humphrey Littleton, and he's playing in Oxford Street.
London's rhythm enthusiasts of all ages put on their zoot suits and go to town. To be precise, Oxford Street. Here, a normally sedate restaurant surrenders its dignity to the excitement of the dancers and the music of Humphrey Littleton. Good fun and good exercise. Rhythm is the only stimulus, as drinks are strictly non-alcoholic.
So the music is different, but you get the idea. Whether we're sitting around the fire at night under a starry sky with friends and enjoying a bit of a meal and a few laughs, that's what we do when we're trying to be friendly. We smile and we laugh, and we put the cares of the world aside, and we have that capacity. Now we need to move forward, I think, and to realize that we do have some, I ask you, do you feel a responsibility to have a bearing, to be able to address the disenfranchised, the people that are feeling that there's no place, what's the answer? If helping people feel connected is to keep trying, is to keep trying to talk. That dialogue, follow the pathway. It's complicated, and that's part of what draws us to masonry. If it was easy, we wouldn't have any interest in it, would we? And you know that. You know what you're like. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you from around the world to all of you for tuning in. And I hope that you'll connect with us again real soon. It's an earlier time, if you can imagine. That was from London. This takes us to another part. We'll go out with this. This is 7:11. Oily Sakili and Marianne Petrusko. Check this out. I think this is really deadly. Yeah. Come back real soon. Take care of yourself. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Cheers. that. See you soon.